that members of the NCOP are still held up in the NCOP. They have got another business that they have to process. So I was thinking that we wait for them and start at 6:30, as this is a joint meeting of the Standing and the Select Committee. Thanks. This is supposed to be a meeting of the Joint Standing and Select Committees, whereby we are going to get a briefing from National Treasury and FIC on amendments of those sections. The meeting is officially open. Let me welcome members of the Standing Committee from NA. Welcome members of the Select Committee, NCOP, Treasury, FIC, and other entities which are here, the media and the stakeholders, officials from Parliament, in particular the support teams of the two committees, respectively. Are there apologies?
Yes, Chairperson. Good evening, Chair and members. Select Committee, we have an apology from Honorable Okamp. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Mongwin, for the apology of Honorable Okamp. Let's move to, before we move, Alan and Mongwin, the agenda, I see item four. What is that? Consideration and adoption of the committee report, and which committee report is this? Good luck. And Alan, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, sorry, Chair. I didn't have my mic on. The tabling was for consideration and report to the committee's chair. So we've drafted the report, but I'm sure Advocate Jenkins, he's been in touch with MP and then officials from the FIC. So, yeah.
No. We don't process committee business in this manner. That we get a briefing, then after that we a report is tabled. Can we do things properly? Because this is a briefing by FIC and National Treasury. And what is supposed to follow is the committee, starting with the NA committee, that is COF, to go about its business of making consultations, that is public participation. And then you compile the report for the committee, we adopt it, present to the chamber, it gets adopted and referred to the NCOP. I think that's the procedure that we have to follow. This procedure is new to me. Why are we doing things in this manner?
Chairperson, may I come in? It's Eunice.
Yes, Comrade Eunice.
Yeah, firstly, I think we should apologize to the members about this confusion about 1800 and 1830. Actually, at about 10 to 6, Fani Jutta was still taking part in the debate, and there were others who might have been affected. So when they planned to have meetings, because the meeting was scheduled to finish at 18:10 on the NCOP side, though it keeps changing too. So it's not the committee secretary's fault, but they should say something like maybe, 18:15, or as soon as both houses have risen, so that people don't get irritated. If it's a single house, then we negotiate to be exempt from the house. So firstly, our apologies. I think both of us owe it to the committee members who joined us at 18:00. But secondly, I must say, I only discovered to my surprise, I think about 20 minutes or so before the meeting that there's some report. And I also put that question to Nkoleleko. How is it that we meet and then we vote on a report? What about public hearings and so on? So he tells me, if I understood him, Chairperson, is that Frank and I will explain. Even so, Chairperson, I think from the outset, we should be very, very wary, even if there's no requirement for public hearings, to actually get a briefing and vote on it. I don't recall ever this happening in the thousands of years I've been here. Maybe it happened in some exceptional circumstances, but we've got legal advice. So I'm at one with you for now. That item on the agenda should be in abeyance and left out, unless they can convince us that there's some reason that we have to vote today. Also, a question presumably National Treasury will have to answer, I'm sure a lot of members want to ask, is if this is so important, why have they come to us? I was told last week by Nkoleleko about the need for this meeting. If it is so important, why have they come to us so late? And why do they want us to rush it in one sitting? So I'm at one with you, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Comrade Yunis, and thanks for joining us. We had already tendered your apology as we waited for the 30 minutes to allow colleagues in the NCOP to finish their business. Does it? Let me allow Advocate Jenkins, and if there are clarity-seeking questions, I will allow for clarity-seeking questions or any other comment, and then I will make a ruling after that. Thanks. Advocate Jenkins, over to you. Advocate Jenkins, I can see him, he's connected. Is he muted? Alan and Kulek, can you call Advocate Jenkins? Because he's there in the platform.
I'm trying to get hold of him now, Chair.
Okay.
I've tried to unmute Advocate Chair while Alan is still trying him on the phone.
Yeah, I can see him is there in the platform, but what the problem is, I'm not sure whether there's a problem of the mic. Or...
Chair's phone is off, it goes straight to voicemail.
Okay, let's get the briefing in the meantime. Probably will join us later and clarify the item that you have put here. Over to Treasury and FIC.
Hi. Sorry, evening, honorable members, and apologies. I'm out here in Berlin with Peter Smith, attending a FATF meeting. Of course, one of the issues that we are very worried about is to make sure we don't get onto the gray list. Chair, this issue, and I think, and apologies for the confusion, I think the problem, I guess, has been that the FIC Act has this strange clause, which we now have in some legislation, which is when certain amendments are made, which normally we do as a Treasury regulation and we consult, that, as you know, with many regulations, I'm not talking of this one, generally they don't go back to Parliament. But in this case, there's a provision that says we must go back to Parliament. And it appears that there's not very clear rules, like when we're passing legislation, in what to do, whether Parliament has to have hearings or not, because it says Parliament needs to adopt the proposed changes in the regulation. So, and Honorable Karim is also right. I think it's a fair question to say, why didn't we do it earlier? But, you know, the process has been a slow one with lots of consultation, and we'll explain some of that. But I think the criticism would still hold that we could have brought it to the committee sooner. And we're certainly not trying to use urgency to say we would like the committee or parliament to adopt it today. But in a sense, given the grey listing this that we face, the sooner we do things, the better for us. It just gives us a positive tick. I think we've talked to Advocate Jenkins because we ourselves were trying to understand what are the rules of Parliament, how does this matter get to come to Parliament, do the committees have to look at it, or because ultimately it seems it's by resolution of the two houses, and there may or may not be a sequence that is NA first or NCOB first. I think those are a lot of the issues that we were trying to understand. But perhaps, Chair, and Peter and I are also just, one of us will have to step out. There's a meeting that we have to attend shortly. But I thought if you allow us, we can start the presentation so you can see what the issues are. And certainly, I think the concerns that both Chair, you and Chair Karim have raised, I think are certainly valid concerns that, you know, we do acknowledge. But I think if you were able to present the slides, you can then decide, and you have the power to decide, of course, and how to approach it. I'll stop there for the moment, Chair, and we can proceed on the presentation when you ask us. I don't know if Edward Jenkins is able to talk now or Chair, so over to you.
Please proceed, Momo, with your presentation. We'll deal with the issue of consultation and public participation later. Let's continue.
Okay, thank you, Chair. You know, with COVID, I mean, this is my first trip overseas out of South Africa, and we also have another delegation that's out there in Ghana. They'll be talking from Ghana. So let me start. I don't know who's, Ellen, have you got the presentation?
Yes, Mama, but I've made Vukile co-host.
He's doing it from Ghana, just so that you know.
Okay.
We've also got the director of the FIC sitting here.
I see he's not on the platform anymore, so let me just open the presentation. I'll run it from my
side. Maybe if you can, if you don't mind, just to do that.
Just give me 1 second.
So, Chair, maybe just by way of background, then I'll just continue to talk. And Peter, you can help me. So these regulations, as I said, they're a form of treasury regulations, but there's a clause in the FIC Act which says that Parliament must approve it. Peter, what's the actual wording?
Good afternoon, members and honorable chairs. The wording is that before the minister will make the amendments to the schedules that we will be discussing today by placing a notice in the Gazette. But before the minister may place that notice in the Gazette, Parliament must approve the amendments. So that's the process that we are grappling with here.
And we were trying to understand what does approve mean. There is one precedent. In 2010, there was an amendment to the schedules, and there was a process that took place where, Peter, you want to say what the process was?
No, I can't remember what the process was. It was too long ago. But I think what happened there was it wasn't the amendments that were proposed then were technical amendments. In other words, it was references to legislation that became outdated that we needed to update in the amendments. So it did not affect any new entities coming into the FIC Act, and therefore there wasn't the requirement for public consultation in that case.
So, Chair, when I use the word regulations, and I guess why Parliament at the time felt they wanted Parliament to consider this is because they an amendment to the schedules in the bill. And Chair, I'm sorry, we can't really control for the noise here. It's a big conference and we've got a little spot, which we hope will be quiet most of the time. So these are amendments to the schedules that are already in the Act. And when I use the word treasury regulations, I'm just putting it in a inaccurate legal way, but because I think that's the normally that there's a process that's more akin to treasury regulations, but these do further or can change the scope in a sense of the act that we have. So Chair, let me move on and just next slide, please. Next slide. So, Chair, as you know, we are, just so that members also don't get confused, because of the mutual evaluation, we are currently reviewing the legislative framework. And as I think we've indicated to Parliament, we will be coming with urgent legislation in July. But this is, in a sense, something that we can do in terms of current legislation and the process we started many months ago, and you'll see the consultation process that we outlined. So it will widen the application of the Act by including additional categories of institutions and businesses that must report on in terms of the FIC Act on suspicious transactions, on cash transaction records, and also to have a customer due diligence approach. And the amendments improve the FIC's ability to provide high quality financial intelligence to law enforcement agencies. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I think the thing is that, you know, we have been sort of laggards, and I think that you can certainly, I guess, blame us as Treasury and on it, that our anti-money laundering system is really well behind international standards in its scope. And so when we've done the mutual evaluation, these are areas that have been highlighted and other countries have moved on a long time ago. And these standards require countries to expand the regulatory framework to not just to a specified list of financial institutions, but also to designated non-financial businesses and professions.
And since October 29, to virtual, you know, your crypto type virtual asset service providers, who we'll call VASPs, they the VAS, and the DNFBPs are the non-financial businesses and professions. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I'm not going to repeat this slide, but as you're aware, the mutual evaluation that we had identified some sectors, including this, the high-risk DNFBPs, that they're not yet captured in our anti-money laundering regime. And therefore, we're also unable to assess the risk. And the FATF report also identified that dealers in precious stones and other high-value minerals, I guess, are not adequately covered in the country's AML regime, anti-money laundering regime. And amendments to this schedule are intended to address these deficiencies relating to the scope of the schedules by including these necessary sectors and business activities into the schedules, such as company service providers and these virtual asset service providers. In addition, the new schedules also streamline the number of supervisory bodies and thereby enhance the quality of supervision and enforcement that's identified in the mutual evaluation report. And as we've said, this will only address a specific area of weaknesses. There's much more that we still have to do to address those weaknesses. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I'm not going to go through this. I think we've pointed out why we have to do all it takes to prevent gray listing. And I think we have been working very hard behind the scenes with all the regulators. And it's not just regulators, agencies as well, like you have the NPA, the Hawks, all of them will have to play a part to make sure that we take some of the recommended type steps to address the weaknesses which the mutual evaluation report, which we reported on to Parliament, I think it was last year sometime. Next slide, please. Chair, what we're going to now then deal with is the consultation process. So it commenced in March 2017, where there were consultations with relevant sectors and supervisory bodies. And that was about a two-year process. And we then published the proposed amendments to the schedules in June 2020, with a closing date of August 2020. The comments that were received were incorporated where relevant. Bear in mind, this we did during COVID times. And there were also, I mean, there were a lot of comments, just under 2,300 comments were kind of not too material, but that were received from one organization called Dear South Africa, which appeared to go online, if I remember, and send these comments. And they just simply opposed the proposed amendments, although 312 supported it. The minister then approved that the amendments be tabled in Parliament at the end of March, after this consultation process was completed. Bear in mind, we were also working on FATF, so we can be, you know, perhaps looking back, we can say, why did we take so long? But that's, I guess, the reason. Next slide. So, Chair, we're going to now get the team just to go through the specific proposals. Chair, I'm going to step out. I will come back, because we've got some meetings that I do have to attend. And Peter also has to attend it, but he's going to remain and go through these slides with the rest of our team. But I'll still be here for a few minutes, Chair. Peter?
Thank you, Mama. So in this part of the presentation, we are going to
explain what the proposed amendments are to each of the items that will be affected by this, the amendments that the minister will be making, just so that members understand what the impact of each of the amendments is. If there is too much disruption in this area where I'm sitting in sort of an open area in the conference center, I will then please let me know from the committee side, and I will ask one of my colleagues from the FIC maybe to step in and carry on. But this is important that we walk members through the scope of the amendment so that it's understood what it is that we are proposing and what the minister will be doing with these amendments. So the first of this, the first batch that I'll be talking about are the amendments to Schedule 1 of the FIC Act. This is the schedule that applies to private sector businesses, financial institutions, and non-financial institutions. And these are then all the institutions that are required to comply with the full set of requirements of the FIC Act, everything starting from identifying the customers, monitoring customer transactions, applying a risk-based approach, and applying financial sanctions, etc. So the first item is an existing item in the FIC Act. It refers to legal practitioners. This is the item that currently covers attorneys, and it still refers to the old legislation that governed the attorney's profession. That legislation has now been replaced with the Legal Practice Act, and therefore we have to update the reference to this legislation. This does not affect the profession as far as its coverage by the FIC Act is concerned. The profession has always been covered by since the inception of the FIC Act. There is one additional aspect that comes into the scope of the FIC Act with this legal change. The Legal Practice Act now allows a certain category of advocates to practice in the same way as attorneys for their own account. And those advocates that practice on the same basis as an attorney would now also be covered by this item in the FIC Act because they are covered by the Legal Practice Act. And so that will be the effect of this amendment. We can move to the next slide. This is again an existing item in the FIC Act. The FIC Act currently refers to providers of or trust companies, in other words, companies that provide professional trust services. The intention with this amendment is to be more clear about the nature of these businesses and to be expressly clear that it covers the provision of setting up trusts, managing trust property, acting as professional trustees, etc. Regardless of what the profession is of the person who provides these services. And these services are generally not only provided by lawyers or attorneys, actually, it's also done by accountants, financial advisors, and so on. So the effect of this amendment will be that it's clear, regardless of the profession of the provider of the service, if they provide these services on a professional basis, that would be covered under this item of the FIC Act as a trust service provider. This is one of the very important amendments that we have to make, also then to bring our scope of the FIC Act in line with the international standards of the Financial Action Task Force. The coverage of trust service providers is one of the key issues that the FATF focuses on, because it gives access to the information on the parties that operate from behind the trust and may use the trust as a veil to conceal the true ownership of property. So we can move to the next slide. This is the technical amendment again, the first one referring to an authorized user of an exchange. This basically refers to securities brokers, stock brokers that trade on stock exchanges such as the JSE.
this is not an this does not extend the scope of the FIC Act, but it it updates the reference to the newer legislation that has replaced the Security Services Act, and then, in other words, the Financial Markets Act. The next item, 7A, sorry, no, on the previous slide, yeah, the new item 7A, this is a new item. In other words, this is one of the categories of the business that will come into the FIC Act that was not previously covered by the FIC Act, namely cooperative banks. At the time when the FIC Act was passed, there was no legislation governing cooperative banks. There was no regulatory system for cooperative banks that came in place much later. But because cooperative banks provide financial services to their members, who are also their customers, we are required to cover them as a particular type of financial institution. This will be achieved through the amendment to insert a new item that will bring the cooperative banks within the scope of the FIC Act. We can move to the next slide. The reference to long-term insurance business is again an existing item in the FIC Act, but the coverage or the scope of this item will be widened with this amendment. It's partly required to make this amendment because of, again, updating references to repealed legislation. The Long-Term Insurance Act was replaced by the Insurance Act, which now both covers long and short-term insurance. In this particular item, we will only be covering long-term insurance, in other words, life assurance, but it will cover a wider scope of life insurance that was previously than what was previously covered. Therefore, this is not just a technical amendment, it's also an extension of the scope. This is again one of those amendments that is necessary for us to make. Life insurance business is seen as part of the core financial institutions of our financial system. We can move to the next slide. The next item is an amendment to an existing item, but it's actually bringing in a whole new category of business within the FIC Act. It will refer to credit providers. Again, this is a category of financial institutions that we have to cover in terms of international standards, but also because we've seen in our experience that there is scope for abuse of the business of credit providers from a money laundering point of view, especially. This wider section of institutions will encompass a fairly broad range of money lending business, including micro lending, etc., which is not previously covered under the FIC Act. Item 12 refers to financial services provider. This is a technical amendment. These are the service providers that are covered by the FICE Act, in other words, in financial intermediaries and advisors. This is simply a technical amendment to replace the word "and" with "or" so that it's clear that it covers both a person who provides intermediary service and also a person who provides advice, and not that the person has to provide both in terms of this item. It does not expand the scope of the act, as all of these providers have been covered for some time in the scope of the FIC Act. We can move to the next one. Item 16 of the schedule currently refers to the Itala Development Finance Corporation. In this proposed amendment, the proposal is to delete the reference to this one specific institution. And the reason for this is that the main business of this institution is the provision of credit. And in other words, the item that I mentioned just a bit earlier on inserting a new category of credit providers will encompass institutions such as Itala and I would say also other similar institutions that are not currently referenced in the FIC Act, such as the Land Bank and so forth. So it's no longer necessary to have this particular institution referred to by name in the FIC Act, and this item has actually become superfluous. So the proposal is to delete this from the scope of the FIC Act. From the schedule, but not from the scope. We can then move to the next slide. The item that currently refers to money remitters in the FIC Act is already a fairly wide category. It refers to any person who's in the business of sending or receiving money on instruction or on behalf of a client. But it refers specifically to money, and so it's therefore, my apologies for that. It's therefore not always applicable to instances where the method of transmission is something that is the effect of moving value from one person to another, but not necessarily through the direct remittance of funds or direct sending of money. So the amendment here is to refer to the remittance of not just money, but also instruments that can transfer value. It is important, again, that this amendment is brought into the FIC Act, because there are many business models that rely on a net settlement of value between the remitters without actually money being sent on a transaction by transaction basis. And it would not be entirely clear. We wouldn't have legal certainty as to whether those are covered by the FIC Act, but they should be covered because they provide the same service as a traditional money remitter. We can move to the next slide. The rest of these items that will follow are all new items. In other words, all categories of business that are currently not covered by the FIC Act. The first one refers to high value goods dealers. In this case, we are proposing that a person who deals in goods that are valued at a transaction value of 100,000 or more would have to comply with the FIC Act for that particular transaction where that item is sold. In other words, these are what one could consider sort of luxury items, valuable items, etc. This would include the category that we would have to cover in terms of the international standard that refers to to dealers in precious metals and stones. But we decided not to refer only to dealers in precious metals and stones, because we believe there are other high-value goods that are equally susceptible to being used in money laundering schemes, or that are equally attractive to people who want to furnish their lifestyle with proceeds of crime. They would normally spend their money first on real estate, which will be covered under items that deal with the estate agency profession, or they will be buying luxury items such as motor vehicles and so on. So we aim to capture the dealers in those types of items under this new item that will be introduced. The next new item will refer to the South African Mint Company. This is a bit of an exceptional item for the FIC Act. As we were discussing just now with Itala, the idea is actually to reduce the reference to specific institutions unless it brings the benefit of more certainty. In this case, the South African Mint Company deals in not just manufacturing of our currency, coins that are in circulation, but they also deal in collectible coins, which are of high value and would therefore, in most instances, fall in the previous item of high value goods dealers. But in our discussions with the Reserve Bank and with the Mint Company itself, specifically on this item, when we were going through the consultation process, they indicated to us that their preference is not to be lumped into this larger general category of high value goods dealers, but for certainty and for them to manage their compliance with the FIC Act, it's easier to be referenced specifically by name, and then there's no uncertainty or question marks within the organization on how it needs to structure itself to comply with the requirements of the FIC Act. We can move to the next slide. This is again a new item and one that we are actually fairly excited about. It will refer to crypto asset service providers. In the FATF language, they call them virtual asset service providers, but the South African regulatory community, not just the FIC, the Reserve Bank and the FSCA and so forth, all refer to these providers as crypto asset service providers. These are typically the exchanges that make it possible for people to buy and sell things like Bitcoin or Ethereum, but also providers that enable people to store the value in wallets and enable them to exchange their cryptocurrency for a different cryptocurrency or exchange it for Rand, for instance, or for any other fiat currency. This is again a requirement under the FATF recommendations now to cover providers that, of these services with under the money laundering legislation of a country. But in our case, we've actually decided to take this step long before the FATF came to a decision to include this in the standards, and the consultations with this industry goes back a number of years on their inclusion under the scope of the FIC Act. And it's because we've had cases and seen experiences where there were actually abuses of people trying to convert criminal proceeds into virtual assets and trying to hide the virtual assets from investigation because they thought it was not traceable if those transactions went through a crypto asset service provider. We were, because of our good cooperation that we've had and because of the consultation process that we've been going through with these providers, we were able in certain cases from working with the FIC, between the FIC and the asset forfeiture unit, actually able to and working very closely with exchange crypto asset exchanges to freeze those transactions. So this is actually something that I think will be a huge benefit for the operation of our FIC Act and also our law enforcement of machinery as people sort of move into the digital age and start making more use of crypto assets. We can move to the next slide. This is a new item that is will not immediately expand the scope of the FIC Act, but it has certainly the potential to expand the scope of the FIC Act in future. It refers to clearing system participants, in other words, participants who provide the services of clearing transactions in our payment system. Currently, that service is limited to banks, and banks are already covered under the FIC Act under a different item, which is not being amended here in this round of amendments. So, the policy from the Reserve Bank and also National Treasury side is that to expand the ability for entrance into this market and start providing this business of clearing system participants for institutions that are not banks. That has not happened yet. There aren't such institutions yet that will be covered by this item, but it's due to happen in future. And we want to be ready for that for those market entrants when they become clearing system participants, then to also immediately as a function step into this category when being covered by the FIC Act. So this is not something that we require consultation currently and would not affect the current market segment, but as and when new market entrants come into this line of business, they will automatically also become accountable institutions under the FIC Act. We can move to the next slide. We're now going to deal with the amendments to Schedule 2 to the FIC Act. So the ones that I've been talking about now will apply to the private sector and will expand the number of the types of institutions that have to comply with the FIC Act. Schedule 2 will deals with the institutions that are responsible for supervising compliance with the FIC Act. So this will rearrange the responsibilities for doing inspections, enforcing compliance, and in some cases also sanctioning non-compliance with the FIC Act if an institution is found to be breaching its obligations under the FIC Act. So the first amendment here will refer to items 1 and 2 of Schedule 2. These are technical amendments. They refer, the current items refer to the Financial Services Board and the Registrar of Banks, respectively. Those institutions don't exist anymore. The legislation that provided for their mandates were repealed and replaced with the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which replaced those two institutions with the Financial Services Financial Service Conduct Authority. Financial Sector Conduct Authority and the Prudential Authority. And we have to update the references to these institutions in the FIC Act now by referring to the Financial Sector Regulation Act. So this is purely a technical amendment. We can move to the next slide. In the next item is a proposal to delete the current reference in the FIC Act Schedule 2 to the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors. When the FIC Act was passed originally in 2001, or enacted in 2001, we understood that auditors provide a broad range of, or auditing firms provide a broad range of services, not just the auditing function, but also functions of estate planning, management of assets for clients and so on. So to a large extent, they provide also services that are of a financial nature, not just auditing in the pure sense of auditing financial statements. It's for that reason at the time when the legislation was passed originally that IRBA was included as the regulatory authority for auditors, and I'd expected that IRBA would then take on the function of supervising compliance of auditing firms for these functions that are not purely auditing functions, but also but actually financial services. As it turned out, especially with the passing coming into operation of the FACE Act, there was a better regulatory framework for these auditing firms that provide further additional services that are actually services that the functions of financial advice or financial intermediary services. And they were then subsequently regulated first by the Financial Services Board and now by the FSCA for those provisions that part of their business that actually makes them a financial services provider. So it's no longer necessary for the FOC Act to have a reference to IRBA. The peer auditing function that is regulated by IRBA is not subject to compliance requirements of the FIC Act, except for obviously the obligation to report suspicious transactions. So there's no actual real need for IRBA to be included in the FIC Act as a supervisory body. And they will not have any instances where they can carry out inspections or can enforce compliance with the FIC Act in their mandate as the regulatory body for the auditing profession. The next item will refer to the deletion of the National Gambling Board. In the 2010 amendments that were made to the schedule, or 2017 amendments, I think, to the schedule, there was a reference added to the provincial licensing authorities that are required to regulate and license gambling activities at the provincial level. The National Gambling Board at the national level does not actually license or supervise gambling activities of casinos, horse racing, betting, etc. That all of that is done at the provincial level and is regulated and supervised by the provincial licensing authorities. And they are already supervisors under the FIC Act. The National Gambling Board was expected to take on the responsibility for supervising internet gambling. And there were amendments made to the National Gambling Act that would have created the enabling environment for internet gambling to be regulated. And for the with the commencement of those provisions, the National Gambling Board would then have become the supervisors for internet gambling supervising compliance with the FIC Act. But those provisions were never brought into operation, and it appears that there will not be a policy brought in place to regulate internet gambling. It's currently illegal, and it seems that it will stay that way for the foreseeable future. So again, the NGB has no real responsibility currently under the FIC Act, and it's a superfluous reference to keep the National Gambling Board in the schedule as a supervisory body. We can move to the next slide. In this item, we are proposing to delete the reference to the law societies. When the FIC Act was enacted originally, the law societies were self-regulatory bodies for the attorney's profession. So they didn't only represent the profession, they also regulated the profession and set the ethical standards and were empowered also to apply to the High Court for attorneys to be struck off the roll to prevent people from practicing as an attorney and so forth. Those functions were now transferred to a new regulatory body that was created recently through the enactment of the Legal Practice Act. And this is the Legal Practice Council that was created. So the law societies no longer have these powers. It's now entrusted to the Legal Practice Council. However, in our discussions with the Legal Practice Council, when the council in its formative process, the Legal Practice Council indicated to us that it would not be in a position to take on the functions and the responsibilities of a supervisor under the FIC Act. They would not have the capacity to enforce the legislation, the compliance with the FIC Act in respect of the legal profession, and they did not envisage that they would have that capacity for the foreseeable future. And it's on that basis then that we are proposing that we have to remove the reference to the law societies, because they have no enforcement powers any further or any regulatory function anymore, but not to replace this reference to law societies with a new reference to the Legal Practice Council. The net effect of this would be that the FIC would become the default supervisor for compliance with the FIC Act for the legal profession. And that's in terms of the provisions of the FIC Act that provides that if there is no existing supervisory body for a particular category of institutions, then the FIC has the responsibility to supervise compliance with those institutions. This means that we still have to maintain a very close working relationship with the Legal Practice Council, because the FIC can only oversee compliance with the FIC Act. But as we do so, we are also likely to find other problems in a legal practice, which we cannot deal with, which would have to be under the authority of the Legal Practice Council. Only the Legal Practice Council would have the authority, for instance, to remove a practitioner from the legal profession. The FIC would not be able to do so. So we have to maintain that relationship with the Legal Practice Council, so that they also understand what we are doing, and understand how they are approaching the regulation of the profession. We can move to the next slide. We are now coming to the amendments to Schedule 3. Schedule 3 of the FIC Act currently only refers to two items, motor vehicle dealers and Krugerrand dealers. And these two categories of business only have the obligation to report suspicious transactions and obligation to report large cash transactions. Transactions of 25,000 Rand in cash, in other words, in notes and coins, and above. They do not have the same obligations to report, to do customer due diligence, to identify customers, to keep records, to monitor transactions, and so on. We've had very good experience with improving compliance with these obligations in these two industries, but we found that the compliance with the reporting obligations in the absence of the requirements to comply with identification, verification, record keeping, those sort of obligations, means that the quality of the information that these institutions can report to the FOC is often not very reliable. and therefore, we've decided rather, when we create the category of high-value goods dealers that I've mentioned earlier, that category will be of a general nature and sufficient to cover also where the nature of the transaction, the goods, high value goods that are being bought and sold is, for instance, a motor vehicle or a collectible coin or a Krugerrand, et cetera. So it's no longer necessary to have this reference to these two specific institutions in Schedule 3 as reporting institutions. Because they will be captured by the reference to high value goods dealers. And it's also not necessary for us to add further new categories of businesses to this item, this schedule. So the net effect of this item will be that there will be no institutions listed on the Schedule 3. We are not proposing to delete Schedule 3 entirely. It may be in future that there is a category of business that comes onto the radar that we might want to include into this this schedule, and we will then have to follow the approach again of consultation with that industry and opening up the possibility that they may be included in the schedule. But for the time being, we do not envisage any businesses in Schedule 3. We can move to the next slide. So I'm coming to the end, a few slides to conclude on the motivations for these amendments. We have experienced firsthand in the metro evaluation process the priority that's given to compliance with anti-money laundering and counter-terror financing standards internationally. This is certainly something that is receiving attention not only in the FATF, but the country's standing and compliance with the FATF sets a benchmark also for other institutions or other organizations when they consider a country's compliance with things like the UN Convention on Corruption, for instance, or the OECD's standards for exchange of information in tax transparency and so forth. So there's sort of a domino effect if a country's compliance with the international standards on money laundering is not up to standard. Our mutual evaluation has certainly pointed out areas where the scope of the FIC Act specifically causes other deficiencies, reduces the effectiveness of our customer due diligence requirements, for instance, in the FIC Act, because it does not apply to certain types of institutions. And this was pointed out in various instances repeatedly in our mutual evaluation report as well. But other than that, the businesses themselves in South Africa and within the South African anti-money laundering framework also stand to gain from being recognized as responsible, well-regulated, well-supervised institutions operating in a clean and well-regulated environment. And we've seen this especially, for instance, with the crypto asset service providers, where they find it difficult to do business with counterparts in regulated sectors, and even in other parts of the world where their counterparts are strictly regulated, and where those institutions are then reluctant to deal with our institutions that are not currently operating within such a regulated environment. We can move to the next slide. In response to the mutual evaluation process, as Momo had mentioned earlier, there's also, apart from these amendments specifically that are necessary to expand the scope of the FIC Act, there's also a very, very big effort underway to address a long list of findings from the Mitch evaluation report in other areas. This has endorsement right from cabinet level. We've previously presented to the Standing Committee of Finance on this in Parliament. But the emphasis here for us is to not just make the amendments that are necessary in the legislation, but also to provide a better framework for ourselves, for us as a country to collaborate and improve the effectiveness and the implementation of that legislation, so that we can actually generate the results that are necessary from the application of the legislation. In the end analysis, this should lead to better quality of information being reported by a broader range of institutions to the FIC Act, to the FIC. And this would allow the FIC to generate better quality information that we can pass on to our colleagues in the law enforcement environment to follow up on through investigations and hopefully also prosecutions and asset forfeitures and convictions and so forth. So this is part of a much bigger effort to improve not just the legal basis, but also the functioning in of our anti-money laundering system. We can move to the next slide. I think Mamo has touched on this already in the beginning, but I think just to reiterate the point, that we're also looking at innovation in our system, not simply dealing with the meeting the FATF requirements or simply ticking boxes that meet the international standard, but also how those improvements can help us introduce new ideas, things like unexplained wealth orders and so forth. These are all discussions that we are currently having within the community of departments and agencies that are working on the follow-up process to our Mitch evaluation. And it's critical that we take the view that this whole process is necessary. One needs a solid foundation in legislation, but then needs to enable us to use the a better range of tools in our combating financial crime of all sorts, and which are perpetuated through money laundering schemes, hiding the trail of proceeds of crime behind front companies or shell companies, etc. So hopefully this better quality information will also sharpen our tools to trace those funds where those sort of techniques of hiding the trail are used in the criminal world. You can move to the next slide. The Mama mentioned in the beginning, these amendments are a form of regulation. I think to explain this a bit further, the amendments are not called regulations per se, but they are in the nature of a regulation in the sense that these are executive actions that the minister takes in terms of the empowering legislation, the specific provisions in the FRC Act that entrusts the minister with this power, similar to the power to make a regulation. The process for the minister to make these, to take these administrative actions is also similar to the making of regulation. For instance, he has to publish a notice in the Gazette to bring the changes into effect. Prior to that, there's a consultation process that's prescribed that must be followed. And the parliamentary oversight is also provided for, which is why we are in the briefing now to present this to the committees. I don't think I need to cover the rest. I think Mamo touched on the urgency that and the way this fits into the follow-up actions to the Financial Action Task Force Mitch evaluation. So I think we can move to the next slide. that maybe this might be the last one.
Yeah, that's the last slide, Peter.
Right. Okay, thank you. Then that concludes the presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Peter, that's the presentation from FIC and National Treasury. Let me invite members of the two committees who would like to ask a clarity seeking questions or make comments to do so now. Dr. George, Honorable Raida, Akbare Dutoi. Yeah, Dr. George.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks very much for the presentation. I must say that this is very alarming to hear, because as far as I understand it, is that FATF warned South Africa in October 2021, and that we were then placed on a watch list, essentially, till October 22, and that if we then did not basically up our game in terms of prosecuting financial crimes, pursuing illicit cash flows, that we would then end up on this grey list, and that the consequences for South Africa's financial institutions would be dire. As mentioned in the presentation, that banks would have a problem transacting internationally, our financial institutions might get fined, etc. So it is actually quite shocking that we are 4 months away from October. Now, I do understand from the acting DG that the Treasury is now in Berlin together with the FIC. So it's obviously that some kind of conversation is going on. So I just want to understand, I mean, I'd like to know, why is it that this has taken so long? So we need to have an answer to that. Is why has this taken so long? And now it's become urgent. And is my understanding correctly that if Parliament does not pass these regulations, obviously, if you're discussing it now with the FATF, they're probably making some kind of demand. So if Parliament does not pass these regulations, are we then going to end up with this dire consequence? Because there is, in fact, a process, as mentioned by the chairperson. And also, there's obviously no doubt whatsoever that they are concerned about illicit cash flows, because we know how onerous the requirements already are on ordinary South Africans. Try and open a bank account, got to prove your address, you get fickered all the time. That's obviously not working, because ordinary South Africans have to climb over this hoop, all these hoops, yet FATF is still not satisfied. So something must be going on in our economy that they are concerned about, that we're not catching in the loop. Obviously, I see how the regulations are proposed to be to tighten up, which seem reasonable on the face of them. But obviously, they would be very concerned about the recent revelations about the possibility of cash, foreign cash, being stuffed into furniture of South Africa's president. So I don't know whether they may have raised that, but that may well be the case. So that's my questions, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Honorable Raida.
Yes, good evening, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I can't help but feel a little bit like we're being bullied or pressured into something. So, there was an ominous comment up front about grey listing, and I think Dr. George has explained a little bit about it to us, but I don't think we've got the full picture yet. What does grey listing mean? We need to do this or we're going to get grey listed. That's quite scary, and I think we need to unpack that for the committee, please, Chair. The opening comment as well from the acting DG, and I note that he doesn't fix his tie even for the people in Berlin, so now I don't feel so bad. But the opening comment that, yeah, he doesn't know why, you know, these regulations have it in it that it was they must come to Parliament. And there's not a firm thing. Well, there's obviously, there was a good reason why that was done up front. And I think that it's important that we interrogate the thing properly, and we don't just get dismissed and kind of treat it almost as an irritation. So I do think we need to go through this process carefully. And I think that this has been just over an hour-long presentation with a lot of great detail in it. And on the surface, I think most of the recommendations and the amendments look entirely reasonable and probably overdue. In fact, certainly overdue considering Dr. George's inputs. But yes, some of the comments that we started the process in 2017 and we're trying to rush it at the end here. I'm a little bit concerned about that. I also wanted to raise a red flag about the comment about there were some objections. There were numerous objections, but there were non-material objections. Now, I'm not sure who's the arbiter of the objections and decides whether they were material or not material, but I do think we need to hear a little bit more about what some of those objections were at the time. So I'm certainly a little uncomfortable with rushing the thing through. I'm aware we're coming up for quite a long recess period, and as Dr. George pointed out, there's a deadline looming. I do think perhaps as members we need to be a little bit flexible with our time and give this thing the proper consideration it clearly needs. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Ryder. Akhbare Dutoy.
Dankie, Akhbare Voorzitter. Honourable Chair, yes, I agree with the two previous speakers. Chair, what's a great concern is still the fact that this thing is rushed. Can we be supplied with a deadline? When the deadline is? What is the last day that this must happen? Obviously, it looks like good proposals, but we need to be supplied with a full document with all the detail in it. We cannot just steamroll it through. I mean, in the beginning, I think it was Mr. Dirk alluded to the fact that, yes, this did happen in 2010. I don't know the details. And then one could assume that the centers could have been completed by, so why can't you do it again now? And if we start with the president by rushing things through, then we will not be playing our oversight role effectively. And at the end of the day, we are the ones that will be responsible and that are responsible for making the correct decisions with regards to this. And if we could please have the legal opinion, I think that will also assist this joint committee. I wanted to allude to upholstery and furniture being stuffed, but yes, that's been covered. Thank you, Sir John. Thank you, Chair.
Peter, can you respond to those clarity-seeking questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. I think just to explain the context of the Financial Action Task Force, and the reason why we are here at the Financial Action Task Force meeting has nothing to do with these amendments that we're talking about. Yeah, the Financial Action Task Force has three annual plenary meetings. One of them usually around February every year, one of them around June, and one around October. So we are now here at the June meetings of the FATF plenary, where they discuss all matters relating to the FATF's business. South Africa is not under discussion at the moment in this meeting. We will be under discussion next year, February. And I'll explain the process that will lead up to that. We have to submit our, let me take a further step back. We were assessed by the FATF. It's called a mutual evaluation. So it means FATF members evaluate each other. We send assessors to countries and they send assessors when it's our turn to be evaluated. And this happened in South Africa's case. Over a period that started before COVID, we had an assessment team in South Africa in 2019 towards the end of the year. They spent most of November 2019 in South Africa. In the lead up to that on-site visit, we supplied them with masses of material, written material that they had to work through for months, and then after the on-site visit, they produced the first versions of the report early in 2020. As we were approaching the meetings of the FATF where our report would have been discussed, this would have been in June 2020, COVID happened, all international business shut down for a while. The FATF did not meet at that time, and there was no opportunity for the FATF to discuss our mutual valuation report until June 2021, when it was eventually then discussed in a virtual meeting of the FATF and adopted. So as from June 2021, we had the report with the findings of the FATF on the mutual valuation. We actually identified this as an issue that needed attention long before the adoption of the report. And our consultations started first with the FIC and National Treasury inviting the affected categories of business and institutions that will be, that are identified here as new business, that are not currently covered by the FIC Act, to workshops one by one, sector by sector, and having very full discussions with them on what it means to become accountable institutions, what implications it would have for those industries, why we believe it's justified that they do become accountable institutions, what the money laundering risks are that they that are faced in those industries, and why we believe, also from their side, why they would expect to be regulated and supervised for compliance with the FIC Act in order to, as I've said earlier, to confirm that they operate within a clean and well overseen environment. So that period carried on for actually more or less 2 years, because it was quite a large number of sectors, representative bodies, institutions, etc., that we had to consult and discuss this, and then had follow-up discussions and consultations until we reached the point, as you saw in the presentation, around 2020, where we could present the minister with a proposal that could then be considered for the minister to follow the formally prescribed consultation process that the FIC Act requires. We had to do all that preparatory work before the minister could initiate the consultation process in order to place the minister in a position where he had a well considered proposal already that he could then go out and follow the consultation process that the FIC Act requires of the minister before he can make these amendments. That is when the discussion document was published that was referred to in the consultation document. And there followed another consultation process then from there, which was now the minister's consultation process, no longer the FIC and Treasury consulting in our own name. Again, a number of comments were received, and I'll touch here on for instance, the reference to the non-material comments. One of the institutions that submitted comments to the minister's consultation document is an institution or organization called Dear South Africa. And what they do is identify instances such as this where government is asking for comments from the public on something, distribute the consultation requirement as widely as possible to members of the public, and invite members of the public to comment on that, which they then collate and then pass back to government, to the institution that is conducting the consultation. So this is not a focused consultation with the sectors that are actually affected by the amendments, which is what the FIC Act requires, consultation, for instance, with the sector of credit providers or with the sector of virtual asset service providers and so on. And therefore, many of the comments that come back are not really relevant to the issues that the minister need to consider for the consideration of the amendments and the impact it would have on that sector if they become accountable institutions. But that consultation process then triggered the need for further discussions either with particular sectors or with particular regulators or supervisors of sectors, which then happened during the beginning of June of 2021, until we reached the point now where those discussions and consultations have been exhausted with those bodies and institutions And where the minister was now ready to formalize the amendments through the notices that were prepared for submission to Parliament, and that can would then also be published in the Gazette. On the issue of the listing, following the Mitchell Evaluation Report, the FATF places a country in a follow-up process, and they do this for every country that is evaluated, regardless of what the outcomes of the evaluation is. However, if the evaluation results are fairly poor in relation to the expectations of an FATF member in terms of the financial the international standard, the follow-up process will be stricter, and the country will have to be will be placed under more pressure to work quicker to address the findings of the report of the Mitchell evaluation, and then report back to the FATF on those actions that the country is taking to address those findings. We have to report to the FATF in our first follow-up report in October this year. There will not be really be a discussion or consideration of the report, but that information will then be kept on the FATF record as our first follow-up report and the first instance where we, first opportunity where we had, were able to demonstrate what we have been working on since the adoption of the report in June 2021. That information will then be considered in the preparation for the February 2023 meeting. The first meeting in the coming year of the FATF, where the FATF will be discussing whether to greylist South Africa or not. And this is because, again, the number of deficiencies that were identified, and especially the poor level of effectiveness that was identified in the Mitchell evaluation report. So these amendments to the schedules is one of a long list of items that we have to address in the lead up to that discussion in preparation for the meeting in February 2023. We have to submit the information for that meeting by around November 2022. And that information that we would be reporting in the follow-up report in October, plus the additional information that we will be submitting in November, will all be taken into account by the FATF when the decision is made, whether they are satisfied with our progress or if they're not satisfied, whether they will greylist South Africa. The implications of greylisting is that the FATF, and any of the members are interested, can look on the FATF's website. There's a link to a list of countries which the FATF identifies as countries with strategic deficiencies in their money laundering anti-terror financing systems. The FATF identifies these countries so that financial institutions or regulators all over the world can take note of those deficiencies and decide whether those deficiencies are material or not for those foreign counterparts in their dealings with South African or with the institutions in the listed country. And in many cases, this means that the foreign counterpart institutions will increase their risk monitoring in relation to their relationships with their counterpart financial institutions in the listed country. They will ask more questions. They will want more assurances of the legitimacy of funds that flow through the transactions in those relationships. In correspondent banking relationships, they want a long list of assurances and checks that the banks will be doing in the listed country before they pass on funds to their counterparts in the foreign country. So the implications are certainly that cost of business goes up. It's certainly that regulators in foreign countries watch institutions much more closely that do business with institutions in the listed countries, so business becomes a lot slower. And the ability to enter new markets internationally become very restricted because the regulators of those markets become very protective of allowing institutions from a listed country into their markets. So the ability of our banks, for instance, to expand globally will become restricted. It has a number of very serious implications, which in a knock-on effect can affect things like international trade, because payments for imports and exports slow down, or the cost of importing, exporting goes up. And the net effect of this is that severe pressure is placed on the institutions that are core to the financial system and to supporting the economy. We've seen this in our engagements with countries that have gone through this experience. And Mauritius just recently came out of this list, and the message from them was that they had a severe impact on the country's economy and the country's financial system. So this is something that is to be taken seriously from the private sector side, especially. The FATF did not identify these.
Can you gallop in your response so that it should not be like you are making another presentation?
Certainly, I'm just trying to run through the last of our questions, Mr. Chair. The only question I think that still needs to be addressed is whether we are being bullied in this grey listing process. I don't think we should see it as a process of being bullied. South Africa subscribed to these international standards voluntarily, and we provided our political commitment that we will uphold these standards. And once a country has done that, they would be expected to comply with these standards, and that's the expectation of us now. By being a member of the FATF, we have subjected ourselves to scrutiny by the FATF, and also to the consequences that come with it. So this is not a case of being bullied, but this is, I misunderstood the question. No, I don't think we're trying to bully the committee with this. I think we fully respect the committee's process to make the decisions. The fact of the matter is that South Africa has to align itself with the international standard. So the urgency is one issue, but whether or not we make these amendments to the FRCA to come in line with the international standard, I think that is something we have to consider as the commitment that we've made, that we will align ourselves with the standard. We will amend our legislation in accordance with the international standard. The urgency, I think, is a different matter, and that is the process that I've explained earlier. That is not something that is entirely within our control, but we're trying our best to meet those timelines so that we can avoid having this discussion in February 2023 with the FATF. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll leave it at that point.
Okay. Thanks, Peter, for the clarity. Are there clarity-seeking questions or follow-up or comments before we move to the next item? In the absence of, okay.
Chair?
Akbare Dutoy?
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I missed it. What is the last date by when this must be approved by the Joint Committee?
Wait, Peter. Peter, you can't speak for Parliament. It is
appointed. That is exactly
you are not elected. You are a bureaucrat. Akbare Dutoy, that is our responsibility, that the two committees to decide as to how we are going to drive the process, and that's going to be the next item. Okay.
Just a clarity speaking, Chair.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I expressed myself incorrectly. I want to know what is the cutoff date, the latest date by which the Joint Committee must conclude and on this. I understand that the committee must determine the date themselves, but what is the latest cutoff date to prevent us from being grey-listed to approve this amendments?
That's a matter that earlier on we requested Advocate Jenkins to clarify. And if you remember, Honorable Karim and myself have raised the issue of the process of how the two committees are supposed to process these amendments, not in the manner that it is presented here, that today we get the presentation, today we adopt the report. Parliament doesn't operate in that manner. If we are done with this item, we can move to the next item. I see Advocate Jenkins is now active. Okay. Advocate Jenkins, earlier on, we were looking for you. When we see an item here in the agenda that the two committees, standing and select committee, should adopt the report today. Can you clarify what this is all about?
Chairperson, thank you. And my apologies to yourselves and to honorable members and everybody on the platform. When the committee starting time was shifted, I had to change my plans and go fetch my kids at a different time, and I didn't get back in time for your question. So my apologies for that. Chairperson, the process of dealing with these regulations in one meeting and then approving them, Chair, I think it really depends on the nature of what we have in front of us. And we received the briefing now, and it's also the first time that I see exactly what is in the amendments of the three schedules. But Chair, to start from the top, when these three, the amendments on the schedules were referred to the two committees, the referral in the ATC says clearly that there must be a report. It's for consideration and report. So the committees do need to report each to the respective house. That report needs to indicate whether the committee approves or disapproves these amendments to the schedules, because that is what's required in terms of the FICA Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act. It requires that there must be parliamentary approval, like Mr. Momoniat mentioned at the outset of the meeting. So what the committees then need to do is to actually comply with what the Constitution says, that is that there must be facilitation of public involvement. Now, part of that was done through the FIC and National Treasury seeking those comments. And that is what Parliament has requested through the legislation, through drafting legislation and making legislation to say, this is what you need to do prior to sending us those drafts for our approval. So Chair, the content, I need to distinguish between the content of the regulations, because they are in fact regulations, and then the approval thereof. The content has been informed obviously by business need, by government need, and by the public comments. Parliament is now expected to approve it. And Chair, I think given the nature of what we're dealing with here, it's prudent for Parliament to at least invite written comments and to just ask for we did get in the PowerPoint presentation a lot about the public participation process. But for Parliament to understand the content and what was said and what was accepted and what wasn't accepted by National Treasury from those public comments, we might need to get those tables that we sometimes get from National Treasury, just to say who commented, what did they say, and what was the response. Now, Chair, this is simply for Parliament to be, for both committees and both houses, to be able to make up its collective mind whether to approve or not to approve. We don't have any power to change the content of the regulations, but we do have an obligation to have public facilitation when we do approval of a regulation such as these. So Chair, my advice would be that part of public participation that Parliament was responsible for, we have delegated that with the power to make the regulation. So we need those submissions somehow in a format. Chair, just a short point on the Dear South Africa. We received that in Parliament as well. The way we deal with it, we ask the website manager or the owner of the website to give us a report, much like we received now from National Treasury, that simply says so many people voted for the amendments and so many people are against the amendments.
those we treat very similar to what was said today in the committee, and one can ask Mr. Wickham if that is so or not. Because as far as my working with Alan goes, it is really just those, it's more of an opinion poll rather than making substantive comments on what is correct, what is workable, what is affordable, to think of three issues that plays a role when we make regulations like this. So, Chair, my fear, or the risk, let me put it this way, the risk that Parliament runs here that we need to manage is that we are dealing with regulations that National Treasury in the presentation has said affects various new groups and new categories of groups. There is a cost to this. There's a cost to the FICA exercise, and it usually goes to the consumers. So I think, Chair, for lack of a better word, Parliament should at least publish these regulations and ask for written comments on them, just to say, not to change them, but to assist with accepting or not accepting. And depending on what one gets from that exercise, we can decide whether we do need public hearings. But Chair, as I said, because Parliament cannot change the content, but only its approval or disapproval, I do not think public hearings will take the matter any further. But I'm just trying to assist the committee to manage time. But Parliament certainly needs to do something in addition to getting the issues of the submissions on the content. Because those only deal with how should we phrase. Parliament's question is different in terms of legislation, is whether we should approve or not. And we need public, just the view of the public on that, Chairperson. So it doesn't need to be an extremely long time for people to decide that. And certainly the advert or the invitation on the website could simply say, we need to approve or disapprove. And we give a week or two or three comments. There's a new standard where we give about 4 weeks of comment. I think that is rather long, unless we want to do it over the recess period and deal with it then in end of July, August. Thank you, Chair. That's all from me. My apologies again, Chair, for not being here in the beginning.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Advocate Jenkins. I see the end of Dr. Lope. Then I will try to summarize and hand over also to Honorable Karim to make closing remarks.
Good evening, Chairperson and members. Chair, the amendment, I thought we allowed as well as just support staff of the committee to have our say in some of these issues. The amendments to the schedules to the Act, I think it was correct when one member suggested that there is a need for some kind of a legal opinion from the legal services, something that is going to be written down, because the amendment to the schedules of the Act are really, it's a lot of things. Like, for instance, if you look at credit providers in South Africa, you've got over 6,101 institutions that you are bringing into this fold. I mean, you bring in institutions such as, you know, Woolworths, because they also provide some credit, you know. And there's also credit bureaus, there's also payment distribution agents. You're talking of high value, dealers in high value goods. That's a number of institutions, and it's not very clear what those are exactly. What are high value goods dealers? And if anyone sells something above 100,000 rand, I mean, do you mean also wholesalers with that? Do you mean also supermarkets? I mean, what do you mean by goods? Do you also include services? You know, there's a lot of things that are being suggested by this amendment. I've got an opinion also on it. It's that it's not just regulations that are being changed here. It's the Act, because the schedules are part of the Act. They are not regulations of the Act. Although there are those provisions in section 73, 75, and 76, which give the minister powers to consult and change and amend, but Parliament also has to have a proper processing of something as big as this, which is going to bring a lot of other institutions into the fold. Like, for instance, you're talking of cooperative banks. Do you also include cooperative financial institutions? If you include credit providers, do you also include the NCR to become a supervisory body? I mean, this is huge amendments, which I think are to the Act rather than regulation itself, because the schedules to the Act are part of the Act itself. So I think there is a need for the committee to tread on this very carefully. On issues of compliance with FATF standards, officials from Treasury need to be able to explain to the FATF that Parliament has to follow processes as well in order to deal with these kinds of issues. So it shouldn't come like some kind of, as one of the members said, we're being bullied here. So they need to be able to explain that Parliament has to follow processes, has to ensure that there is public participation, because Parliament doesn't know what the consultation process came up with. And if you look at the Law Society and the LPC says it's not going to be able to, got no capacity to be a supervisory board, how are you going to deal with all those issues? So there's a lot of issues here. We only received this today, then I had to go through it. Then I thought that members will have to be very careful in dealing with this, because there could be challenges when people are not given a chance to comment on this by Parliament, not only by the minister. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, colleagues. Let me
make
remarks and then hand over to
Chairperson. Chairperson, before you do, can I just come in, because I'm a bit confused, right? And I put my hand up, and then you can round up, because really you're chairing the meeting. Chairperson, I think we're all agreeing that we need to avoid the grey listing at all costs, that what's here is mostly updating and strengthening the requirements, the need to tackle illicit financial flows and money laundering and terrorism and whatever else that's related to that. So I don't think there's any disagreement about that. But I wanted to ask, Chairperson, I'm very, very puzzled about what's going on here. Firstly, Frank, and before we conclude, can Frank explain to us, this came to my attention, I'm not sure, last week or the week before. I was just merely told it's a briefing. And I think our committee was told earlier in this week, or I was told privately over the phone, that it's like going to be 45 minutes or so. It's just a briefing. As I said, I only discovered a report's going to be adopted today, about 20 minutes or 10 minutes before the meeting. I didn't know about this, Chairperson. I don't know if your secretary told you, but as I said, it's very puzzling what's going on here. So firstly, if I can explain the referral, is it for a joint sitting, a joint report, or if I understand you correctly, it's basically referred to the two committees. And usually with 75, it first goes to the NA, and then they finalize the process and they bring it to us. Now, who is the joint report? Secondly, Frank, as far as I know, the legislation provides for the way in which there's approval of regulations. Comrade Chair, sometimes, as I know it, the bill, the law will say, the legislation will say, the bill will say, and then we adopt it. Or we make changes like we did in the Municipal Systems Act, where we require the minister to present all regulations to Parliament. And before they're implemented, they have to be approved by a parliamentary committee. But we put a provision, if this doesn't happen within 90 working days or whatever it was, 60 working days, it can be presumed to be adopted, so that the minister and government are not held up by the tardiness of Parliament. Elsewhere, it says it's merely for tabling. Then they just come and table it to us and we listen to it. We can offer our views, but they don't have to listen to us. We can even have hearings, but they don't have to listen to us. Then there's a third form of tabling. I forgot what it is. I'm getting old now. So I don't know what the Act says, what the FICA says. Does it say it has to be approved in the sense is what I think you're saying, Frank? In that case, it surely is clear. It was firstly done by the NA and then by the NCOP. So we should leave the NA to do its process. This is just a joint briefing on the like any other bill. Then I'm very glad that Sakila has spoken. Some of the things I wanted to say are covered, but we took it far further than I did. I don't think we can have no public notice. So I think that's clear. I fully support Fran Chairperson. They must give us all the submissions we often ask for when it comes to bills introduced to Parliament for the first time. We say, tell us what the public told you. Nothing stops the public from appearing before Parliament or writing to us and saying, you're Parliament, you're the ultimate decision makers. We want to still raise the same matters with you as they often do. Now, whether that applies to this regulation or depends on the category and what the law says. Does it say in what sense we have to approve? In other words, if we don't approve, I think they can't go ahead. The other thing that's clear to me, I raised this a few minutes before 6 o'clock with the secretary. As far as I know, I think Zakir is right, Frank. Amendments to the schedule are an amendment to the Act. A regulation is something that is like a rule that the Act provides the minister and department to draw up to take into account, you know, changing circumstances. For example, that's why we don't contend with the figure that for something, if you transgress some law, you know, you get a 10-round fine. But 20 years later, 10-round is meaningless, so you can change it. So we say change that through regulation. You can just table that in Parliament, etc. So I just want to say, Chip, and I had a complete misunderstanding. It's almost surrealistic. I thought that you had been approached by the minister or DG and the matter explained to you. And then what we are doing today is getting a briefing, and then maybe because your committee's looked at this some way, you're going to adopt some report. That's what I concluded just before 6 o'clock. And then we will have to look at your report and then look at what the amendments are and discuss it as we would any other regulation that requires approval of Parliament. So I'm confused about how this thing got onto the agenda. And I think the secretary should be very careful about allowing this to happen, because I thought it's an NA thing on a report, if there's one that has been adopted. Meanwhile, you don't know anything about it, Chairperson. So I think the secretary should be very cautious. They have to consult with the chairs and ask us whether such a thing is done. Befuddles me how this thing got onto the agenda, this item of adopting a report. As I said, I don't know any other experience since 1994 of this nature. But what also bemuses me, Chairperson, we shouldn't let National Treasury get off lightly. I mean, I think they're one of the most hardworking departments, Chairperson. That's my subjective view. But they also know very well. I mean, the acting DG has been here for thousands of years. How they expected us to vote on this today is it's bemusing and amusing, really. It's absurd, actually. So I don't know how this got here. Who pushed for this to go onto the agenda of adopting a report? Where is the report? Normally the chairs have to see the report beforehand. We don't present a report to the committee without us approving of it first. So nobody's given me a report. And I don't think anybody's given you a report, Chairperson. So I don't even know how this thing got onto the agenda. So I would urge the secretaries to be very cautious so we don't go through this. The question I want to put to Peter and whoever else can answer it. You know what? From what I can tell, you have to submit all the information in November, okay? So the October deadline is not as urgent, presumably, as your November deadline. Secondly, I think the NA will not be sitting against you. In any case, they can't adopt this thing in the House. And thirdly, we would prefer if the Section 75, as I think it is, it must first go to the NA. We meet next week. We could take it to the House if there was a need for it. But the NA, unless you're meeting next week, you can't even if we adopted the report today. What would the NA have done with it, Chairperson? I'm presuming you're not meeting next week. So you can't do anything with it if that's the case, that you're not sitting next week. The House can't meet next week. And we're not going to, I mean, there's a Section 75, Frank, can we talk offline? We don't want to adopt it before the NA does. It's a Section 75, as I know it, and it's a national issue. There's no separate provincial dynamic here, so it doesn't make sense for us to adopt it. So let us proceed as if, you know, we do with the Section 75 amendments to a bill, in this case, it's regulations. So I really don't think, Chairperson. The other thing I wanted to ask finally
And I don't think we need answers to all these litany of questions. You brought this upon yourself, Treasury. You know what? You don't have to answer offline. Just send it to the chairs we'll forward it to. For example, Peter, can't you and Treasury negotiate for an extension? It may look bad, but, you know, maybe for a three-month extension or something. But I can't see, Chairperson, this bill going through until, let's say, the end of August on your side. And then with us, we'll process it very quickly. We can say middle of September. Even that's before end of October. That's the best I think we can do, but we can't make any promises, Chairperson. It depends on the magnitude, scope, and gravity of what people say. But I think overall, we're not going to get a huge deluge that will make us substantially change things. Although Sakila raises some very interesting questions, Chairperson, that I hadn't thought about the scope of this thing. And if what he's saying is correct, Treasury is even more, you know, somebody said bullying. Okay, if the bullying is coming from Treasury, Treasury is even more out of order. If the latitude of what this amendments to the regulations are, is what Zakhele Shlope suggests, then really it's something that Treasury needs to answer, Zakhele. Not now necessarily. What is going on here, Chairperson? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Karim. Unless Advocate Jenkins or Peter will want to respond to one or two questions so that we move towards closing the meeting. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the provisions in the Financial Intelligence Center Act requires Parliament to approve the amendments to Schedule 1, 2, and 3 in three separate sections in the Act. I think it's Section 73, 75, and 76, Schedule 1, 2, and 3. So in each of those, it sets out what the schedule is in, and it gives the power to the minister then to amend the schedule to include or to exempt someone from those schedules. It says clearly in each provision that if there's a single person that's been affected by the amendment made by the minister, that person must get 30 days to respond. If there's more than one or a category of persons that's been affected, those category must get 60 days to respond. And then it says, after these amendments have been proposed or made in a draft form, there must be a publication in the Gazette, but first it must be approved by Parliament. So, Chair, on that point, I would just like to say that Parliament, through delegating this function to the minister, has said to the minister, make sure that you consult everybody that will be affected by the amendment. So what one can do from Parliament's side, if we put out an advert or a invitation for people to comment, if someone says we are affected by it, but we didn't get the opportunity to make this submission, and then clearly there's been a non-compliance issue with that empowering provision of the minister, and one must then maybe ask the minister to redo that part. That's not for Parliament to do. We've in legislation said the minister must do that. So what the public participation that we would want is we want to see what has happened in the executive side of this exercise, and then to maybe invite people just to say whether that should be approved or not, because that's what's expected of us. Chairperson, just 2 points. The one is we're talking about amending the Act or amending regulations. For me, it's really a conceptual issue. When we look at Section 101 of the Constitution, it speaks of instruments of subordinate legislation, whether those are regulations, proclamations, or other instruments. Regulations, proclamations, or other instruments are always part of the Act. Yesterday, we dealt with this morning that we dealt with possible amendments to the PFMA. Regulations have the same power as the Act. You have to comply with it. It's just who makes them and under what conditions. So, Chair, here we have schedules. They're not, strictly speaking, regulations. They're instruments of subordinate legislation. And, Chair, in this regard, I compare them a little bit to international agreements when it comes to the procedure. There's no requirement that the NA must do it before the NCOP. The committees can decide that. but it's not a Section 75 legislation that is approved by the National Assembly and then the NCOP can propose changes and it go back to the National Assembly. Here we have two houses. It's been referred separately. We need two separate reports. It's not a joint committee. It's simply for efficiency that I think the committees are conferring. So each house must decide on its own whether to approve it or not, much like an international agreement. So Chair, I don't want to take too much time on this issue. I'll just leave it for that there. If there's another question, I'm still here, Chair. Thanks.
There's a question that Honorable Karim asked as to who drafted this report, which him and myself don't even have up to now, but we are told that we must adopt the report.
Chair, it's
where's the report?
I'm like Pontius Pilatus, it wasn't me. Chair, I don't know. I think it was also done with the expectation maybe that it will be efficient to do it now. So I don't want to go too much into it. But Chair, I didn't draft the report. I did see some questions around it. I was asked that to make an input. I've seen the report before. And whether it would be suffice, my advice was that the report needs to just state clearly whether the committee recommends approval by the House or not, because that's what's required in terms of the IFICA Act. So, Chair, I think that is where we are with that. But I would suggest, Chair, that we move towards proper consideration before we deal with the report, Chairperson, as the referral to the committee was made in the ATC. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Honorable Karim and colleagues, National Treasury, FIC. We'll have to do things proper as a legislative body. So I think colleagues have gone through what the Constitution provides in terms of public participation. In terms of Section 59, because public participation is regulated by Section 59.1A and 72.1A for NCOP. 59 says that the National Assembly must facilitate public involvement in the legislative and other processes of the assembly and its committees and conduct its business in an open manner and hold its sittings and those of its committees in public, and it goes on and on and on. And then 72.1A makes the same provision for the NCOP that you must go through public participation. There are case laws in this regard when it comes to public participation. Almost three of them. If you remember, there was a Supreme Court of Appeal case in King and others versus attorneys, Fidelity Fund, Board of Control, and others. Also, there was a Constitutional Court case, Doctors for Life International versus the Speaker of the National Assembly and others. Three, there was also a Matatiela Municipality and others versus the president of the RSA and others. All these case laws make it very clear that whenever Parliament embarks on a legislative process and other processes, it must consult the public. 59 is very clear. It's not even saying you have got an option. It says it must. Subsequent to all these case laws, Parliament adopted what we call a public participation model, which reads thus, the core values of the public participation are based on the will of the people. Those affected by a decision have a right and responsibilities to be involved in the decision-making process. It includes promise that the public's contribution will be considered for decisions and inputs will be acknowledged. To promote sustainable decisions by recognizing and communicating the needs and interests of all participants, including decision makers, and seeks out and facilitate the involvement of those potentially affected by or interested in a decision. That is a public participation model adopted by Parliament, which is in line with the spirit and the letter of participatory democracy. Treasury has gone through a laborious process of consultation from 2017 and has provided us with a number of those that have consulted. And in this figure that has been presented, it's like more people compared to those who agreed were against the regulations. It's what is written here, because you say there were 2,295 comments. Out of that, 1,983 of the comments were opposed to the amendments, and 312 supported the amendments. So what we are going to do as an NA, I won't speak for NCOP, Honorable Karim is here. We are going to embark on a public participation process and make sure that those who are affected by these amendments make their voice to be heard. There's no other way. Parliament is an independent arm of government from the executive. I think that should be very clear. How we are going to drive the process in terms of the timeframes and so on and so on, we'll discuss that with the support team as to how do we expedite the process. But we are not going to adopt the report today before we go to the public, because that's a constitutional imperative and also in line with the public participation model of Parliament. So that's what we have to do and make sure that we do things properly, because it will be of no use that I, as the chairperson of the committee, say, let's adopt the report today. Tomorrow, these 1,983 stakeholders take the speaker to court, because I, as a chairperson, does not appear in court. The executive authority of Parliament, and I mean the National Assembly, is the speaker, and the NCOP is the chairperson. It will be reckless on my side to do that and put the speaker at risk. So let's do the things properly, and it will arrive at the same destination that all of us want to achieve, and make sure that we don't have problems that keeps on coming back, that you have been consulted and so on and so on. So that's what I can say in regards to the process that the SCOF is going to follow from now moving forward. Honorable Karim, over to you. You make remarks so that we can close the meeting.
No, Chair, I completely agree with you. There's nothing for me to say, so thank you for chairing the meeting. What's a possibility you and I can discuss is maybe, you know, in terms of the rules, Frank and the legal services unit have said, we can have a hearing on your side with the participation of a joint briefing on legislation allowed in terms of the rules, although there are one or two people here who don't agree with that, but that's between them, the Constitutional Court, and the legal services unit. But because it's regulations, because it's urgent, one possibility is when you call your public hearings on your side, it's with our participation. So it's your NA hearings and then we participate. In effect means when it comes to doing the report, we obviously don't participate, because then we oversee that report when it comes to the NCOP. But we can discuss that offline. Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks to everybody else.
Thanks, Honorable Karim. Let's welcome Mr. Momuniat as the acting DG, because now you are in a new capacity. So we have to officially welcome you. As much as you are part of us, but the responsibility that has been bestowed on you needs to be acknowledged properly. And we wish you all the best in steering the National Treasury ship until such time that a DG is appointed.
Chairperson, I think we should reprimand Dennis Ryder for observing that Momo didn't have his tie fitted on properly, even at an international conference. It's only 28 years, Chairperson, since he's been forced to wear a tie. It's too soon for him to get it right. So I think we should give him a bit more time. Thank you.
Are we going to succeed? Because he's left with 1 or 2 years to go on patient.
The admonishment is taken, Chair.
Okay. Okay, Honorable Ryder. Thanks very much, colleagues from NA, NCOP, National Treasury, FIC, the support teams from Parliament, media, and all the stakeholders who are in the platform. Good night. Thanks. The meeting is officially closed.
Thank you, Chair.
Night, Chair. Congratulations.